The murdered Labour MP, Joe Cox, said, "We are far more united and have far more in common than that which divides us." Looking at some of the division on social media today, it feels like we've still got some way to go. Welcome to the Walk a Mile in My Shoes podcast. I'm your host, Chris Young, and in this episode, I speak with Mark Cameron, a guy I met, had a bit of a disagreement with on Twitter about HS2. Without going too far into that, it turned out we were both wrong. We chatted, we sent each other our books, and the rest was, well, have a listen. Remember, if you enjoy the podcast, subscribe, comment, rate, and review. That way we can get more people involved in the conversation. Hi, welcome to the Walk a Mile in My Shoes podcast. Hi, Mark, how are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, Chris. Fridays are always a good day, right?
Yeah. So it's great that you agreed to come on, because what I'm trying to do is emulate my coastal walk, where to give people an idea what it's like to just bump into random people as I went around and talk about what it's like to be them, and to get the listener to understand what it's like to be you. Can you tell the listener where you and I first met?
Well, we met on Twitter, I believe. A little, not a spat, a disagreement over HS2, where we had differing views. And it turned out that neither of us were really experts on the subject, because some kind soul, I think, who was fully immersed in the project and actually knew the facts, put us straight. And it kind of proved, don't believe all the news you see on social media, really, because we ended up actually finding more in common between ourselves than uncommon.
You are absolutely right. I mean, that's the thing that really struck me, was that, I mean, our next step was, and I don't think this is open to everybody on Twitter, we sent each other our books. So we would each learn more about each other.
Yeah, that was an eye-opener, wasn't it? It's, you know, we kind of, when we started digging deeper and I found out about you walking around the UK, and I'm like, hey, I run around the UK. That's what I enjoy doing. That's why I quit work 3 years ago and really changed my life. I wrote a book about my adventures, and so did you.
Yeah.
And looking at you right now, we've both got very minimal hair, so we've got so much in common. It's unbelievable. And you know, that's what I like to do. I like to, even in my day job, I say to people, you know, we have workshops, we have meetings, and it can be quite fractious sometimes. And I say to people, look, why do we focus on the 10% that we don't agree on? Why don't we move ahead on the 90% we do agree on?
Yeah, because it is usually
90%. Life would be so much better.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, you know, the name of your book is The Diary of an Average Runner, with the subtitle Never Ever Give Up. Just starting there, who are you talking to with that subtitle?
Me.
Yeah.
I wrote the book for myself. Yeah. I never even intended anyone to read it.
Right.
I wrote it because I got myself in a bit of a dark place, feeling sorry for myself, and I'd learned something about through my day job called Johari Window, which is really, you know, look at yourself how other people see you.
Right.
So look from the outside in rather than from the inside out. And so I said, what's the best way to self-reflect on myself and to look at myself from the outside in? Write a book.
Right.
You know, go through your Facebook, your Google Photos, your all these types of things, and just summarize it in a book and read it back to yourself. And you will realize that life ain't really that bad, to be honest.
Right.
And
right.
As I was writing it, it did help. But then I realized that I'd met so many great people.
Yeah.
Through adventuring around the UK.
Yeah.
And I thought, why be selfish and don't share it? Yeah. Share it and say thank you to people, and share it and say to people who may be in a similar situation to you, look, life ain't that bad. Just look at the 90% that's good.
That's key, isn't it? Because very often I'll get that done, I'll get that done, I'll get that done. And we never really celebrate getting things done. It's like we're in this endless list of things to do.
I think it's greed, isn't it? We're always after the next thing.
Whether
you're eating some food or, you know, buying yourself some clothes, it's instant gratification and you move on to the next thing.
Yeah, it's I think that sort of sums up Western society rather well. Go into your book. I mean, the thing that sort of struck me is this sort of your passage really through physical activity and how you sort of arrived at where you are today. I'm hugely oversimplifying this, but you started out as a weightlifter.
Yeah, I was massively overweight.
Right.
I had a rugby background at school, so weight wasn't, you know, weight was good. And I love my food. I have a Maltese mother, and the Maltese love feeding you.
Right, right.
More is better. Food, lots of food. And that's fine by me because I love food.
Yeah.
And my wife loves growing vegetables and fruits and baking. Right, so she took over from my mum and started feeding me as well. And and I just grew and grew and grew. And I grew to 20, 21 stone, and I was only 5'7".
Right, right.
And, but the powerlifting, the bod, and the strongman shows were kind of, they worked in my favor, right? Because I was big. I was big and I was strong and I was quite short. So I was quite powerful to that. And that's where it came from. But then I got to a point in my life where I was sort of reaching 30. Of course, it's not quite a midlife crisis, but it's a 30-year crisis.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, this is all very good, but when I looked around me, and I used to laugh, you know, the world's getting obese, you know, people are unfit and all this sort of stuff. And again, I looked at myself and it's like, you're in danger of becoming one of them people. And I thought, and the only person who can help me is myself.
Sure.
And so I just changed my life a bit, changed the training I was doing. And I try to lose some weight, but sometimes losing weight is always optional, right? It's optional until you have health problems almost.
Yes.
And so I kind of set myself a goal of entering a bodybuilding show, because then it wasn't optional. You stand on a stage in front of 1,000 people in a sparkly tan and a tiny pair of pants, and you're there to be laughed at. If you've if you've cheated on your diet, people will laugh at you, right? And I've never done a show before, never done bodybuilding before, but I have a very, not just a strong body, but a very strong mind. And I thought, well, you know, the fear of being laughed at was what drove me to starting to lose weight. And that's what I did.
But you also describe yourself, I think, as a bit of an introvert as well. So it's
definitely, yeah,
quite an unusual.
This was, it's a strange one. It's like when you're big and strong, you kind of, you've got something to sort of hide behind, I guess. You've got your strength and all that type of stuff, which worked out well. I was doing nightclub security and all that. Wasn't afraid to go and do whatever I needed to do when I was working there. But when it come to, I mean, put it this way, I wouldn't walk down the beach without a big t-shirt on because I wanted to cover myself up.
Right, right.
Kind of avoided conversations with people, which is weird because people say that I am quite chatty, and I definitely am nowadays. But I thought, you know, I was getting married. I'd never really had a proper job, but I had to start. I thought, actually, in my 30s, it's now or never, got to get a proper job.
Sure.
And I thought, well, the bodybuilding is just another way to fix that introvert side a little bit.
Right.
Because you have no choice. If you stand up there and you're fat, you look stupid. If you stand there and you don't move around the stage and pose, you look stupid.
Right.
So it was kind of fixing two problems at the same time. And that definitely held me in good stead for the next 10 years as I moved into what people would call a career.
Right. So I hadn't really sort of thought of that as sort of, you know, working in parallel, you know, your work life and your bodybuilding life, I guess. And also, am I right in thinking that the percentage of body fat you require for bodybuilding is much less than, say, if you're an athlete?
It's an unhealthy figure. You literally get down to it and you can probably live like it for a few weeks without starting to get health problems.
Gosh,
your skin is, the idea is that your skin is so paper thin that you can see the muscle fibers and the veins underneath.
Yes.
I ended up, I did two shows on consecutive weekends, and I won them both. And then I scratched myself with a thorn in the garden. And I always get allergic reactions to plants. And this time I got a really bad reaction because basically there was nothing protecting my blood stream. And I ended up with septicemia in my arm a massive abscess on my arm.
Yeah.
And I was in hospital. I had my arm, drained. And for about a year, I just had a big hole in my arm. And that's when I kind of thought, actually, the bodybuilding helped me get a bit more healthy.
Yeah.
But the sport went past the tipping point.
Sure.
And it became an unhealthy sport. I mean, unhealthy with regards to my physical health. Definitely, even though it fixed a lot of things, I would say my mental health was way out of control back then. I don't know if you've ever tried to take a bone away from a hungry dog and they will snap at you.
Right.
That's basically what I was like with food when I was bodybuilding, and I had the temper of a rabid dog, and I would just, I was vile back then.
So constantly on a short fuse.
Always on the foot. Yeah. With working in the clubs and things like that as well. Thank God there wasn't camera phones back then. That's what I can say.
Oh my God. Yeah, of course. Because that would have been all invasive, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it wasn't good times.
One of the things that really struck me in your book is that you describe yourself as happy on the outside but lonely on the inside.
Yeah, I think we all are sometimes, especially right now. Definitely, I think that's just being true when a lot of people are the opposite, right? I mean, in a world where someone says, "Oh, I've got 10,000 Instagram fans," and yet I'm going through depression. I'm like, so you haven't really got 10,000 friends, right? You haven't got 50,000 likes because you still feel lonely.
Yeah.
And some people won't actually admit that. Some people will admit it for other reasons. But I do get lonely. I miss human interaction.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want it full on.
Yeah.
I like to be able to get away. I kind of almost need a fix of it every now and again.
But you need to be in charge of it.
Yes, definitely.
I get that. So you went from being a weightlifter. I mean, was it a sort of an epiphany one day? You went, "What am I doing?" And then you transitioned to becoming a runner, or was that more gradual?
So that was gradual. I mean, I quit the bodybuilding after 3 years. I'd done pretty well.
Yeah.
I'd had sponsorship. I'd placed third in Britain.
Wow.
You know, I'd been around the UK doing shows. Then the septicemia came in, left me with a big scar on my arm. And I realized that to get from third in Britain to first in Britain and, you know, go beyond that was a risky game against my health.
Sure.
And also not just about my health, but about my relationship. You know, I've been with my wife, 25 years now?
Right.
So I kind of thought, what's the benefits of sticking with the bodybuilding? You know, and I looked at people that I knew who had been really successful. And even though when you're on stage, you're kind of getting screamed at by loads of fans and you feel it, you're looking on top of the world. That's definitely a really lonely place as well, right? Because it's a very selfish sport.
Yeah.
And so I thought, it's time to get out while the going's good. Still got my health, still got my arm, still got my wife.
Yeah, still got my arm. I mean, that's a real leveler.
I'm not in prison through my temper ages. Time to get out while the going's good. Get married, which is what I did. Well, time to grow up, basically. So, yeah, got married. And I'm looking at a picture of my wife as I'm talking, actually. And, we got married, and I went and got what I call a proper job. I got a career.
Right.
And I went to work in a insurance company. Within the first year I'd had three jobs because I don't settle very long in anywhere, but I wanted to work for a big company so I could move around within the company.
Sure.
And I quickly found that I had a bit of a knack for identifying problems and trying to find solutions.
Right.
What they call continuous improvement. And I got a managerial job there. And the managerial job was an interesting one because I applied for it and it was managing a claims team. And I was told, you haven't been here long enough and you have no claims experience. And I said to them, I'm not applying to handle claims. I'm I'm applying to look after a team of people who handle claims.
Yes.
And it's a very different thing. You know, no one likes a boss who's an expert and tells everyone, oh, this is how you should do it. You kind of use the team to tell you how to
absolutely,
do it.
And
so that's what I did. They gave me a 6-month trial, which turned into 2 years, and several underperforming teams, which we turned into high performing teams. And then we had consultants coming in doing what was called a global lean transformation program. And they came to my team and they're like, you've done pretty much all of this already. Where did you learn about lean? And I'm like, I don't even know what you're talking about.
Right.
And it was, they explained, and I'm like, surely that's just common sense.
Yes.
Why would anyone want to put up with a frustrating job which bores the hell out of them? I says, I don't understand why people want to do it. All I try to do is get rid of the waste and make people happy, give them a value-adding job.
Yeah.
And I kind of almost fell into a role of head of lean and continuous improvement across Europe and the Middle East.
So that's for workers and for the company. So everybody is experiencing, you know, the benefit of the job. It's not just, you know, working for the managers trying to get it.
No, yeah. And this was, yeah. I mean, it was, to me, I was standing up for the person that I used to be, but was never listened to, right?
Yeah,
I was frustrated in jobs, never listened to by management. So you move on because the company isn't going to change for little old Mark or little old Chris, right? You're just a small part in a big company. So my mission was to almost like, I wanted to help the management solve the business problems, but I wanted the staff to have a great life and to enjoy work.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. I wouldn't just solve the problems. I would train them on continuous improvement and problem solving. I would ask them what frustrates them in their job.
Yeah.
And we'd work together. We'd come up with some solutions. And then I would use my position to go to the management and say, what do you think about this? It's not going to cost you very much. It's low risk. Your staff want to do it. Let's go for it.
So, and that's almost like, what I did. Almost like you're a translator. Yes.
I am.
This is what the bosses are saying. And you tell that to the workers. And then you're saying to the worker, going to the managers and saying, what the workers actually want is this. Yeah, it sounds like a great job.
I called myself, all I was a facilitator of discussions.
Yeah.
That's all it was. And I made a great career out of that. I traveled all over Europe, met so many great people. Russia all the way down to Portugal.
Right.
I was always in Switzerland, which was where my team was based. Even though I stayed in the UK, I was always in Paris. I did pretty well. I did my Lean Master Black Belt while I was at this company. So I did the training in Los Angeles, and then I did the project in Paris. And when I could choose anywhere to go to do the project, and I said to the COO, I want to go to Paris and do it. And he's like, why on earth do you want to go to Paris? You don't even speak French. And I said to him, the whole point of this training isn't for me to get a certificate, because I didn't do A levels, I didn't do a degree. I did GCSEs and I breezed them.
Yeah,
they weren't hard. So I was one of these annoying people who did them pretty easily, but I just couldn't see the value in spending another 5-6 years in a classroom just learning stuff and regurgitating it for an exam. It was just pointless. So I went and worked instead. And so when I did my Lean Master Black Belt qualification, I said to the boss, I want to go to Paris because I want to improve myself, not because I want to get a certificate. If I wanted to get a certificate, I would have taken the easy route and gone to Switzerland, where they're all, you know, they speak English, they've all got fabulous degrees, and they could almost do the project for me, and I just collect certificate at the end. It says, in Paris, I don't speak French, you know, it's a very different culture working-wise. I said, it's going to challenge me. I said, and that's the whole point of doing this.
So did language ever get in the way?
No, because when you work for an international company, you know, the business language is always English.
Right.
I did GCSE English, the GCSE French, but I hadn't used it for like 12 years.
Sure.
But I could use the franglais, right? And I could just say the odd word, which would be an icebreaker. I think the thing that when you're working with people, it doesn't matter what company or what job you're in, you have to empathize with people. You have to have a real sort of interpersonal relationship with them. And what you have to appreciate when you're working with company or people in other countries is, even if they speak English, it's still hard for them, right? They're having to constantly translate what's in their head.
Yes,
almost use a Google Translate in their brain to, and it's, you can tell the pressure. So if you kind of say, actually, every 20 minutes, we're going to take a break.
Yeah.
Or, okay, this is what we need to solve. Now, go off in a corner and speak in French and solve it. And then come to, back to me with a solution. So it's about, you know, it's not, oh, you've got to speak English for 7 hours today, because you're just going to wear them out. And if you're trying to do problem solving, you're trying to energize people, not wear them out. It's stupid.
So being a facilitator, it's your job to literally walk a mile in their shoes.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Put myself, you know, if I was in your position and I was having to speak French, you know, I mean, for a start, probably couldn't for more than a few minutes.
Yeah.
But I would definitely need regular breaks.
To rest your weary brain.
Right? I mean, it's interesting when you're saying, the French culture is fabulous, right? They have a really interesting culture over there. I mean, I experienced it in lots of countries, but, you know, in France, there is almost like a set time to start work. There is, you're going to have a break for a coffee at this time.
Right.
There is, you're definitely going to have an hour for lunch, and you're going to leave the office and go and have your lunch.
Yeah.
There's a definite finishing time. And you have to understand all these types of things and put yourself, as you said, in their shoes. Because if you say, I'll give you an example, say you're in Spain and you're working, which I've worked in Spain a lot, and you say, actually, we're going to take a lunch break at 12:30.
Right.
It's never going to work. It's never going to work in Spain, because they probably only had their breakfast at 10. You know, they want to have their lunch at 2:30. The same with the Italians.
Right.
If you're in Switzerland and you say, okay, we're going to go to lunch at 2:00 because we've got Italians, the Swiss will go, well, we normally go at 11:30.
Right. So completely different cultures.
Yeah, but it adds a great dimension to the job.
I bet. Really, and something as simple and straightforward as that, you know, that makes it's like building the foundation on which you can actually build the sort of purposeful work.
I think it's an often missed factor in, you know, I mean, I know a lot of people who are far, far cleverer than me, right? A lot cleverer. I don't pretend I'm the cleverest person in the world, and I never want to be honest. But, you know, what some people do, they're so academic, they're so clever on these things.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to start at 9, we're going to break at 1, we're going to go back at 2, and we're going to finish at 6.
Yeah.
They don't even notice people's faces rolling their eyes. You know, but this is what we're going to do, because this is what happens in theory, you know, and it's, you need someone who can empathize with the people and say, actually, that's not going
to
work.
So people are just, when they're being told what to do, they immediately start disengaging, and at the end of the day, you're not going to get the result that you want, even though you're trying to coerce people.
Well, I mean, the biggest compliment that I always ask for isn't a successful result, because life means you will never be always successful,
sure,
right?
Sure.
I think the biggest compliment I can have is, I'd like to work with you again.
Right, right.
You know, and I've worked with some great people, but would I want to work with them again? Definitely not.
Right.
Definitely not.
Yeah.
But they've got the results, right? They've got the results. It's on their CV, and they've gone and got a promotion or got a pay rise or got another great job somewhere else. And I'm like, Jesus, I'm, you know, good luck to you.
And we all know people like that. We all do. You know, you're talking to me, I immediately can think of, you know, at least 5, maybe 10 managers who were that focused, who didn't really want to hear what other people thought about the process.
Yeah. I mean, there's an African proverb that I love, and it goes, if you want to go fast, go alone.
Yeah.
But if you want to go far, go together.
You know, I'd written that down because I thought that was fantastic, and I thought your use of it in your book was absolutely bang on.
Yeah.
This is really funny, because I thought you and I would have been talking an awful lot about running and you know, developing your shorter distances into longer distances and into.
I think running is just a means to an end, right? I'm searching for this holy grail of happiness.
Yeah.
And, you know, at this stage of my life, it could be running, it could be adventuring, it could be cycling, it could be whatever. You know, and you kind of, if you say, actually, it's running, and you stick with running, you kind of may just wear yourself out, even if you're not enjoying it. You kind of need to think, what am I doing this for?
Yes, yes.
You know, it's not because I'm going to go and qualify for the Olympics. It's nothing to do with running.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
because I like being outside. I like having fresh air. I like feeling fit and healthy. I like spending time with people.
excuse me.
That's why I like doing it.
Yeah, yeah. And it sounds like, I mean, it developed. I mean, the whole thing about when you were running longer distances, I remember I used to run, I ran up to half marathon. I decided, I nearly ran a marathon and thought, actually, I don't want to do this. I don't want to run a marathon. But the thing I found really irritating when people, while I was running in races, people would start talking to me. I think, how can you talk?
Yeah, when you're sort of panting for breath and someone's just, oh, hi, how are you? And I'm like, yeah, I know the feeling. I know the feeling. So it's frustrating. It's inspiring. It's frustrating. I think, crikey, you know, I've got a long way to go. But I like talking to people, so I've kind of learned.
Of course.
You know, I mean, if you see, I can run and talk, but I need to slow down.
Yes. Yes.
So you know, I've slowed down a lot in the last year. Optional.
Yeah,
I've started running with my heart rate rather than with pace.
Okay.
And if you keep your heart rate low, it's, you know, it may take longer to get to the destination, but you kind of, because you've slowed down, you appreciate everything around you far more.
Right.
You're not competing for a personal best, or you're not competing for a podium place. You're competing because you want to be outside. As I said, doing what you love, appreciate, you know, different people want different things, but I want to be able to go out, see the environment, smell the fresh air, hear the birds. I know it all sounds a little bit blah, but
that's why
I do it. I won't even run with headphones on because I'm like that's one of my senses gone.
Sure,
you know, I've lost the sense of hearing, you know. And like last night, me and my wife went running down the local trail. And you could hear the seagulls on the right-hand side, and you could hear the blackbirds on the left-hand side.
Wow!
And it was amazing.
There's running and training, but there's also you still want to run in events.
I do.
Yeah.
I haven't entered any events for the last 2 years now.
Okay.
I am lucky enough to have the support from a running company called Maverick, and they allow me to sort of enter their races, you know, for free. Me and my wife volunteer at some of the races, and we get free race places back and that type of thing. So I do that, but I said, I'm not paying for any more races, not because I can't afford it, but just because I didn't see the point. You know, you'd get a medal at the end, and I used to say, I don't want the medal. I don't need the medal,
so
I'd give that back. You know, and you'd find that you're racing against the clock because there's cutoffs and things like that. I don't want that. So I said to my wife 2 years ago, I said, I'm not going to pay to enter any more races. I said, because I want to slow down. I want to enjoy them. And so what I started doing was just sourcing off the internet interesting routes that I'd like to do. Some of the Southwest Coastal Path, the Fan Dance up Penny Fan, the Yorkshire Three Peaks, running up Ben Nevis, things like that. And I would just find the routes, get the GPS, and just put it on my watch, pack a bag, and tell my wife, drop me off here and pick me up in 5 hours, 6 hours, 8 hours.
Sure,
and I'll just go off and do it on my own.
So ultra running became a thing for you. What is ultra running?
Basically a race any longer than a marathon.
Okay.
So anything longer than 26.2 miles. I did it because I just thought, you know, the enjoyment factor will increase the further I go.
Yeah, yeah.
So 5K, I enjoy it. 10K, it's okay. Half marathon, it's okay. Marathon, yeah. You know, when I finished my first marathon, I laid there and I looked at my wife and said, she goes, oh, well done, you've done it. I'm like, yeah, I thought I'd feel differently.
Right,
I thought it'd feel different.
Right.
I said, maybe if I go a bit further, it'd be better. And I started going further.
And is it meditative? Is it spiritual?
think it can be, definitely. I mean, especially if you're not running on the roads. If you're running in, like my second ultra marathon was going through the Peak District.
Right, right.
And that was a mixture of things. I ran with some great people, some really amazing people, some who had got to know me just off social media, and some were just because I just find people more friendly when you're out in the middle of nowhere. Everyone has more time for everyone else. Yes, so they all slow down and talk to you. Yes. And it can be, you know, I mean, normally I'd say it's meditative. Sometimes you're running with someone, but you won't even speak to each other for an hour. You're just running with each other.
It's that company.
And that's quite a kind of, that's quite a nice mental feeling, you know, because you've got the support, but there's no, you know, there's no expectation on each other to do anything.
That's quite intimate, isn't it? You know, just being with somebody without feeling the need to do or say anything.
Yeah, it's just being comfortable in each other's company. Yeah. I mean, that's what a marriage is about. And you kind of, you know, when you're running with someone, it's the same thing. You're relying on each other, and it's just nice to have the company. You don't need anything in return.
Right. Now, that's really interesting. I'd not considered that. So the reason I ask about the sort of meditative spiritual side is that the only ultra runner I ever knew was a guy who was a Buddhist, and he did his ultra running round a track. So he would run for something like 12 hours round a track.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't imagine doing that.
I know people who would do it 24-hour races, literally going around a 400-meter track, so many laps in one direction and so many laps in the other direction to set the hip drop. And it's great mental training, you know, you do have to go into a trance. I mean, the bodybuilding set me up mentally, you know, to stick to a diet and stick to a training plan. Even when the going gets tough, that set me up for my career. And that's why I did well in my career, because I wasn't scared to travel. I mean, people say to me, Mark, don't you get worried going into these countries? You don't know anyone there. You don't speak their languages, and you just roll up and you do a project or you do training. I'm like, I've stood in front of 2,000 people in a pair of pants. I said, I don't really. Of course, you can get worried. I mean, I read a book once where it says you can get worried about things or you can get excited about things. Exactly the same feeling. It's how you react to the same situation, right? And if you think about all the bad things, you can get worried. And if you think about all the good things, you can get excited. And so that's what I used to do. And so that set me up. And then the running, it's the same thing. It's just a mental discipline. It's one foot in front of the other. Don't worry about the speed. Think about where it's taking you. The excitement of where it takes you will get you through to the end. The reason I took it up was because I was traveling all over Europe, and I was going back to my old days of eating too much, expenses and hotel food. And I had all the excuses in the world why I was putting weight on. And then I thought, but what's stopping you taking a pair of trainers, shorts and a t-shirt? It's like, well, because you're not a runner. Yeah. I'm like, no, but you weren't a bodybuilder, but you did that. You weren't a career person. You did that. What's stopping you? And it's like, yeah, absolutely right. There's nothing stopping me. Wow. So it was like couch to 5K, run between lampposts, walk between the next lamppost, run again and just keep building it up.
Right,
that's all it was.
Right. Just small steps and manageable steps.
Yeah, you know, I mean, when you're talking about problem solving, you say you can, if you think of the big goal, it can scare the hell out of you. But if you break it down into manageable chunks, it's far easier. And that's all you're doing in running. It doesn't matter if you're running between lampposts or, I mean, I've got a trick on my watch. And if I'm counting down distance on my watch, I'll only set it to count down from 10. Because I know that as soon as I set off, I'll be at 9.99 and it's single digits.
Yes.
Whereas if I was doing 50K, it's like, bloody hell, that's 50, 49, 48, all the way down. And it just seems like a massive goal. Whereas if I've got five lots of 10K,
yes.
It feels far easier.
I've got that, yeah. That's interesting. One of the things I was always in and around this sort of group of people. I've run and I've done triathlon and I've done aquathon, but the thing that always amazed me were fell runners.
They're brilliant, aren't they?
How do they manage
I mean, the last time I saw some fell runners, me and my mate were going up Scarfell Pike, and these people ran past us like gazelles. And he and I were sort of plodding, trying to make sure we didn't break our ankles, and yet they bounce by and they don't seem to even be looking at the feet.
Obviously, I mean, it's in the family, right? Because a lot of fell runners originated from farmers, and they live on the fells, and they're always walking up and down. And I learned that when I did my race in the Peak District, or my first one. There was a guy, he was in his 60s, and he was hurtling down that hill. And I'm like, how the hell have you managed that? It was so inspiring. And that's kind of, I thought, actually, what's stopping me doing that? So that's what I started doing, was trying to do it. And I managed it, but the thing is kind of, I don't have the hereditary background. My skeleton isn't built like his, right? And it's kind of, I'm heavier than him. I'm more sedate with my job than him.
Sure.
And that's when I started injuring myself more, because even though I could hurtle down the hill, the impact on my knees was just ridiculous.
It's the percussion, isn't it? Yeah.
You know, so, but yeah, and what I like about fell runners is it's raw, right? They're not into the latest tech or the newest shoes.
No,
it's an old scruffy club vest and shorts barely long enough to hide your privates, and an old pair of trainers. I mean, they don't even, in the purest form, they don't even mark a course. You know, they kind of say, right, you're going to run from Edel to wherever, and then you're going to go along there, and then you come back. And there's no route markings, because they don't want to ruin the environment.
Right.
They don't like route markings. It's kind of, no, you know, you should know the area because you live here.
Wow.
And we want to leave no trace behind us, basically.
No idea. I thought there was, but that,
I mean, they originally started. They were just an event as part of the country shows, I think. You know, turn up on the day, pay a few quid, do the race, and you get a free beer at the end.
Yeah,
that was it. You know,
astonishing.
And, I love those people. I think they, you know, it just proves that it's open to anyone, right? There's nothing stopping anyone, because they run so simply, and so happy. I mean, that's why I like running up north, because you meet those types of people.
It's interesting, as you hear David Attenborough talking about how, as humans, we seem to spend all our time fighting to become, make sure we're apart from nature, when actually these guys are a part of nature. You know, they're part of the hills, they're part of that environment.
And, yeah, all weathers, you know, they're out there. I watched a YouTube video on the Dark Peak fell runners, and that's where the old guy that I mentioned about from the Peak District was from.
Right,
and it's an old fell running club, and it's a massive part of the community. It gels everyone together. It's all inclusive, kids, males, females, fast, slow.
Yeah,
fabulous.
You
know, no headphones, no running with headphones or a phone in your hand.
Yeah,
it's just go and run.
Amazing. That sounds really exciting. I mean, I'd recommend to anybody, go watch and see what it's like, because it is a real spectacle. Now, I was looking, jumping away from that. I was sort of looking at a bit of your, I was doing my Mark homework, and I see that you, towards the end of last year, you lost your job, and you describe yourself as pulling up the hatches and in the hope of staying mentally and physically safe. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So lost my job. I mean, that's when probably the occasion I've lost many jobs.
Right.
Past.
Okay.
Become a bit more resilient to it nowadays. But after 13 years in a job, and it becomes part of your life, it wasn't an involuntary loss.
Yeah.
I mean, it got to a stage where, to me, it was, you know, I could stay here for the rest of my life, or I could go and do other things, and I wanted to do other things. And an opportunity came up to take redundancy or to stay on. I could have done either. And I said to my wife, you know what, I'm going to take a chance. I haven't got anything to go to.
Right.
I said, you know, we've got each other, and that's the main thing. We'll be fine. And that's what I did. I left the job after 13 years. It was a bit scary because, you know, I still never felt that, even though I had this head of regional role, and actually I'd moved into head office into a global role by that stage, I never felt worthy of actually having that job because I'd never sort of never felt like clever enough. All I was doing was facilitating discussions and do it. I was almost, you know, I remember when I got the job,
yeah.
I was in Switzerland doing a workshop and I got an email from HR saying, congratulations, here's your new grade and here's your new salary and this details of your car allowance and your pension and your healthcare. And I'm like, I phoned my boss. I said, I think I've got a email that should be for someone else. He goes, why? I says, because I've just been promoted to a couple of grades and given a pay rise and all these other benefits. I says, and I don't deserve it. I goes, I'm not doing anything special.
Right.
And he said, no, you are. I goes, I'm just doing what I enjoy doing. I says, and the fact that I'm actually getting paid to do it is a bonus to me. And, you know, I was like, well, Mark, we think you're worth it. And I'm like, wow, you know, and it made me wonder, why am I leaving a company who've done that to me? Because they obviously have been good to me. And it was quite scary because I thought, you know, will I find another company that believes in me like this one does? And that was quite, it was weird. It was like I'd sort of, when I finished there, I'd sort of sit at home some days and I'd literally sit on the sofa and just, well, actually, no, it was as I was going through the leaving process sometimes, I was working at home, sit on the sofa, I'd literally cry because right, I'm like, right. What the hell am I doing? What am I doing? You know, so many self-doubts. You know, will you get another job? Will you be able to provide for the family? What are you going to do with your life? You have no plans,
yeah,
apart from this funny, this almost fantasy of doing what you love.
Yeah.
You know, that's all I wanted to do was just do what I love, you know, be with who I love, do what I love, and not have to put up with things that I don't enjoy anymore. You know, because I saw lots of people pretending to do what they love and you just knew that they hated every minute of it. And I didn't want to be like that.
Sure.
I worked with a lot of very successful people. But when I looked around at them in meeting rooms, they looked so lonely and bored. And I'm like, even though I admire you, I don't want to be like you.
Yeah, that's a world you didn't want to be in.
Yeah. So it was kind of a brave step to step away. And I felt lonely because it's kind of, you know, once you leave a company, it's like they don't, no one really cares about you.
No.
You know, you were there, you're useful, and someone else comes along and they take over your role. And I said to them, you know, there's a lot of good kids that I've trained up over the years that could do a far better job than me, to be honest. It's time to step aside and let them do it. So that's what I did. And it was a lonely time, but I didn't take the easy option. I didn't sort of go and apply for permanent jobs or anything like that. I said, actually, I know what I want to do. I've taken this step away and I'm going to make the best of it. And that's what I did. So that was about 4 years ago now.
Wow. It sounds like that, even though, you know, you said that your job had value and, you know, from your own perspective, your job had value, and yet you didn't need to have academic qualifications. It sounded like, to me, I mean, I could be well off the mark here, that there's a little niggle in you thinking, you know, I don't have a piece of paper that says I'm a this or I'm a that.
I didn't, no. It was strange, actually, because I did. I had my Lean Master Black Belt certificate, which was a weird one. I don't know. I still didn't feel like I'd earned it because, you know, it was something that I just enjoyed doing.
Right.
I kind of got rewarded for doing, not having to try particularly hard, because to me it was a bit like when I, you know, when I was at school, I got an A star in maths, right? And I didn't really have to study hard to get that.
No,
because naturally it just came to me quite straightforward. You know, computer programming, same thing.
Yeah.
And even though I got the grade, did I earn it? Not really. It was just one of those things. You know, it was just an easy thing. That's why when I said to you, I went to Paris to do the project, I thought, you know, I kind of, you know, I want to earn this. I want to do it the hard way.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I could have stayed in that job and carried on with the pension and the bonus and the salary and all that. And I could have got to, you know, my goal has always been to be in a position to do what I love by the time I'm 50. And by I mean do what I love. It could be work, but it has to be work that I really enjoy.
Yeah.
It could be something totally different, right? And I could have stayed there for another 5 years and got to that 50 very easily.
Yeah.
But, you know, I didn't want to do that. I like the challenge. I like the challenge that I felt when I was running, right? And sometimes you kind of, you're struggling to go up a hill and you think, I need to find a way. Or you've got lost and you think, I need to find a way. You know, that's, my job was about problem solving. And you need to be the best example of what you teach sometimes. And if you're teaching people about problem solving, but you're in an easy position yourself, you're not really a good example of what you're teaching, right?
You're not solving problems anymore.
People like, yeah, I can see why you know what you're talking about, because you've done what you've done.
Right.
And sometimes, okay, you've done what you've done, you've got to a certain stage, and then you go onto easy street, and it's like, well, no, because there's so many other things around. Why, you know, it's all right to take a breather on easy street, but it's kind of, you need to find the next challenge.
Yeah.
And that's what I did in my 40s. I, you know, my middle to late 40s, which is where I am now. I wouldn't say I'm struggling, but it keeps me on my toes, that's for sure. It keeps me alert and keeps me, I think what it does do is, you know, I mean, when you're in a salary job, it is quite easy because you know what's coming next almost. When you're, I wouldn't say I'm living in the moment or living by the day, but it is quite short term sometimes. You kind of have to keep yourself on your toes, because if you don't perform, you know, you're going to find it a struggle to get another job you know, to do something else. You're only as good as your reputation from your last success. And it's kind of, that's how I like that pressure. Definitely like that pressure.
And that pressure is purely internal. Am I right?
Definitely a pressure on myself. I put all the pressure on myself. I don't let anyone put pressure on me anymore.
No.
Because I don't need it. I put enough on me as it is.
I think your brilliant leveler of, this will never be as bad as standing up in front of 2,000 people in my pants. I think that's, you know, that as an external pressure, I think, you know, there's very little that's going to ever sort of overcome that, is there?
Yeah, it's strange though, isn't it? Because the last year, I mean, I said to my wife, you know, the last year I kind of haven't drifted into easy street. I've kind of gone between two jobs in the last, during this COVID lockdown, which has definitely kept me on my toes. But because of the lockdown, you know, I haven't had the adventures. I mean, we've done a few adventures last year. We got away a bit, but I do say to my wife, I'm getting itchy feet. I need something that scares the shit out of me again right now.
Yeah.
You know, I say to her, you know, my goal is to move. You know, we've lived where we've lived on the, just outside of Portsmouth on the South Coast all our lives. And I say to her, I need to go and move somewhere else.
Right.
I said, I used to want to move up to, you know, I've been to Peak District, Yorkshire Dales, the Lake District, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland. And I love those places. And I'd love to live those places. Yeah. But being a southerner, I don't think I could adapt nowadays. You know, I kind of still like the sun. I still like the dry. If I had a flood in my house like those poor folks in Yorkshire do, I don't know what the hell I'd do, you know. So I probably will still travel to those areas, but I kind of look west. I look at Cornwall, Devon, Somerset area, because it's a slower way of life and I can kind of explore. I'd love to kind of, I mean, I've chipped off a lot of the southwest coastal path, but I'd love to just go and do something crazy, like try and go around that on my own, or tick off all the tours on Dartmoor, something like that. And I say to her, you know, if I could, I joke to her, but it's probably real. I look at houses online at the moment. I won't even go look at them because I won't travel beyond, you know, 20 miles of our house. I haven't done for the last year, really, apart from the odd occasion. But I look at houses and I say to my wife, if that was on eBay and I could bid for it, I probably would.
Right. I mean, these are stunning parts of the world, and you are right. They're certainly up north. They are invariably wet. It's stunning. So, you talk about Sally, your wife, and how does she fit into this? It sounds like she's a great facilitator.
She's the, if you thought about a heart rate monitor, stuck to someone in a hospital.
Yeah.
You ideally just want, you know, just a nice calm heartbeat. That's what Sally is. And mine would be the one just at the stage they're about to have a heart attack. And I'm up and down, up and down.
Right,
you know,
right,
not just
right.
my moods, but how I live my life. And she's the leveler in our life, and she brings me back down to earth.
Right.
And she's, you know, because of that, you know, it's kind of is why I am the person I am, because I know that no matter what happens, you know, to me with my job, with my health, whatever, she would always be there because she's the reliable one. She's the one with the, you know, 70 beats, 60 beats a minute heart rate constant. She's
sure,
been in the,
sure.
she's been in the same job for 30 years. She loves being outside. She's got an allotment. She loves growing things, but she doesn't just grow things. She grows things. She bakes things. She takes the seeds out of the things that she's grown. She puts them to one side and she turns them into new produce the following year. So
wow.
she likes the whole cycle of
yeah,
life.
Yeah.
You know, she loves doing all that sort of stuff. And I say to her, you know, I've had this, these adventures all of my life. And I want her to have the same thing. I said, I want you to have a little bit of variability. What I want her to do, the challenge for her this year is to go part-time. And then I said, within the next couple of years, we will move. I says, and you will lose your job. I
right.
says, you will move.
Yeah,
and I says, and
yeah.
you will lose your job. I said, but I will get you a nice little house with a massive garden where you can grow everything that you want.
Yeah,
you can bake
yeah.
whatever you like. You will go to the farmers markets, which we love visiting,
yeah, yeah.
and you won't visit the stalls. You will be one of the stalls.
Yes, yeah.
I said, then you will love it.
How lovely would that
I said,
be?
You know, but after 30 years of being very stable, I mean, I found it hard after 13 years, so I
yeah.
can only imagine how
yeah.
she'll find it after 30.
I think you become sort of institutionalized, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, that's what I'm going to do. That's what's going to happen within the next year or two, without a doubt.
And the complementary part of that is that the theme that seems to run throughout your life is cake.
Yeah, definitely. Is running a means to an end or an end to a means? I mean, it's like I eat too much cake, so I have to run to lose the weight. Or is the cake a reward at the end of a run? I'm not too sure sometimes,
yeah,
but... I do love cake. Sally makes me cake. I mean, it's a nice side effect of COVID, but I used to be cake just at the weekends. And nowadays she gets home at 3 o'clock. I'm working from home. So we'll have homemade biscuits or cake.
Sure.
And then we'll have our dinner at 7, 8 o'clock. And then I may have homemade dessert. And at the weekends, it's double up lunch and dinner cake. And that's probably why I'm running 100+ kilometers a week, every week right now, just to burn the bloody calories off. I mean, Sally's got a physical job. She's an engineer
at a
manufacturing company. She's naturally slim. But as
yeah,
I said, I wouldn't be 20 stone if I wasn't running right now. I reckon I'd be way over that.
Okay, right.
So, but hey, you know, as I found out, you know, when I was bodybuilding, I was incredibly successful, but dieted the arse out of myself.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
I wouldn't go about. Was I happy? No, I wasn't happy. Now I'm doing a different sport. I'm not that successful in the sport, but I eat whatever I like and I'm bloody happy.
Yeah.
So to me, which is the best way? You know, being successful or being happy? Well, it's being happy any day of the week.
It sounds like it. It sounds like, you know, that you've taken the time to think about what makes you happy, and you've facilitated that for yourself.
Yep.
And I'm wondering
I've basically problem solved my life.
Yeah, yeah. And
be the best example of what you teach.
But it doesn't sound like, you know, you're waving some big noisy flag saying, look at this. It's like you've just kind of got on with it gently.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Why would I want to, apart from, you know, the book I never, you know, I didn't go to a publisher. I literally wrote the book and pressed send. I didn't even proofread it. I just said to my wife when she got home, she didn't even know I was writing it. I got home and I said, Sally, I've written a book. I goes, and I've just published it. I says, I've never read it. I said, I literally wrote it,
yeah.
self-reflected and pressed publisher. Goes, can you read it quickly in case I've upset anyone? And that's kind of what I did. But I wasn't after, you know, praise or anything for the book.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, for my life, I mean, what's I would say, what's it got to do with other people? You know, other people just get jealous and they go, oh, you know, you should have stayed in your job, or, you know, that's never going to work. It's just like jealousy. It's like, why do I even want to attract that jealousy? If I just keep it to myself and just get on with my life, don't do harm for anyone else. And along the way, if I help a few people here and there, then that's great. But normally the book comes up because I have conversations like we're doing now. It's not because I've advertised it on a website.
It is about having those conversations. I agree. I think that is the whole reason for writing a book. You don't write a book to make millions. You write a book to have to start a conversation.
Definitely. Yeah. And that's what I've done. And I've made so many good connections out of the book, you know, meaningful ones. You wouldn't say, you know, I mean, it's been downloaded over 10,000 times, and that's great, and it's had a lot of good reviews on Amazon and Goodreads and places like that, and that's fine. I said, but it's the dozen or so people that I've had really close relationships with, you know, people who have actually written their own books as a result of it, and they say, Mark, have you read my book yet? And I'm like, I'm just about to. I remember one guy, Angel Poles, Dave Smith, and he wrote a book. And he put me in the credits because it was because of me that he
wrote his
went
book.
In. Yeah. Wow. And I'm like, amazing, you know. And another guy just contacts me. He said, we're almost pen pals, old fashioned pen pals, you know, never met. He lives up in the Peak District. I remember, I think his dad had a stroke and died and he was a bit down. He read my book and he said, it got me out.
Right.
He said, it got me out. And they said, now he goes running with his wife. He does ultra marathons. He hasn't written a book. It doesn't matter.
Interesting.
But we keep in touch.
Yeah, that's lovely. We're sadly running out of time, you and I. It's.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it? When you set this up, I said, I don't think, you know, can we limit it to an hour? But I could speak all day. I'd love to flip it. I'd love to speak all day and ask you the questions as well, to be honest. I'm reading your book.
Yeah, brilliant.
So, I've got a lot of sort of questions coming off the back of your book. So,
we could maybe set that up. And if you want to interview me, I'd be happy to go for that.
That would be an experience. So, yeah, let me finish your book and we can do the opposite way.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay.
Then you could put yourself in my shoes.
Yes. That'd be an absolute hoot. Listen, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks ever so much for coming on and telling people really what it's like to be you and, just sharing your story. That's been absolutely great, Mark. Thanks a lot.
Brilliant experience. Thank you.
Okay. You take care.
And you.
Huge thanks to Mark for coming on to the show. You can find a link to his book in the blurb. I think it's worth saying this again. We are far more united and have far more in common than that which divides us. I'm not sure if it's the nature of Twitter. Perhaps 280 characters doesn't give us the space to explore those grey areas, which means it's easier for us to become polarised. I don't know. It would be so easy to blame a social media platform for our own divisive behaviours. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Remember, if you enjoyed the podcast, subscribe, comment, rate and review. It really does leave me with a warm, fuzzy feeling inside. Until the next time, I've been Chris Young, and you've been rather fabulous. Walk a mile.